Well, warm welcome to everyone. So, Brother John McColl has been preparing some thoughts, which I'm sure will prove very interesting. His subject is the events between the Old and the New Testament. And as you'll know, I'm sure the last word of the Old Testament is the word curse. And the opening line of Matthew 2 is, "This is the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah." And so Brother John will be speaking about in between those two aspects tonight. Okay, we're going to have a reading partway through. John will give me the nod from 1 Maccabees chapter 3. So that'll be interesting. Don't look for any Bibles. I won't either. But before that, we're going to have an introductory reading from Daniel 2, which we're much more familiar with. So Daniel 2, and we're just reading the events where Daniel is interpreting one of Nebuchadnezzar's dreams. So verse 30 for connection to verse 45. So with that wonderful introductory reading of wonderful things to come, we now hand over to Brother John, and again his the title of his talk is The Events Between the Old and the New Testament. Thanks, John.
So yes, we are going to be looking at these events between the Old and the New Testament, and obviously because we're looking at the events between the Testaments, we have to do a bit of research and hunting to find out what actually occurs during that time. And one thing I did want to just sort of mention, so there was quite a few different references that I've looked through over the years on this topic. Originally I had done this as a Sunday school class and spent a year going through all of the history. Obviously we're not going to sort of get through all of that. So this night, we've got a couple of nights on this. This night and in about a month's time we've got a second session. And it's really just going to be an overview of some of the main events that occurred during that period between the Testaments. But some of the resources that I looked at covered obviously things like NIV study Bibles. Josephus, a Jewish historian, obviously has a lot of information between the Testaments. Study notes on Daniel as well. The Jerusalem Bible, which contains the Apocrypha, and we'll talk about that in a bit of detail a little bit later as well. Wikipedia a little bit, the Jewish Online Encyclopedia, and of course the Story of the Bible by Percy Mansfield. One of the other things I used was a Bible handbook, and I must say that, you know, particularly for the younger ones, if you ever get a chance to get a Bible handbook like this, they're really quite useful. They give a good overview of, general overview of the different books of the Bible and so forth. But things that I found really useful in it is that, they have many charts that give you ideas of, when the different books of the Bible were written. And, I think the time charts are the most useful thing to really get the context of what's going on at different times. So, yeah, something like that, really useful thing if you can get hold of one. And so what are we going to cover over these two classes? Tonight we're going to look at the Old Testament and the New Testament and the timelines from those. We're going to have a look at the historical context of the Testaments, and particularly we're going to look at Daniel chapter 2, a little bit of Daniel chapter 7, where there is obviously the reference to the various empires, the kingdoms, the Babylonian, Greek, Roman. We will look at Daniel 11 as well, because that has quite a bit of detail around the Greek Empire. We're going to have a look at the Maccabees, the Apocrypha, explain what that's about, the Hasmonean dynasty, and finally look at the Pharisees and Sadducees just a little bit tonight as to what they were doing. And then in the next class, we're going to spend a little bit more time looking at the Pharisees and Sadducees. We're going to look at the Roman Empire, the various rulers of the Roman Empire, who they were, where they ruled, and what they were doing at the time. We'll have a look at the family of Herod, which is quite interesting, and the Herodian dynasty and the mess that family was. And then we'll finish by looking at the time of Christ and look at, who of these Roman rulers is actually ruling at that time and where they appear in the New Testament. So that we can sort of link that right through to the New Testament. Okay, so as I said, we're going to refer to this chart a few times. And I'm just going to get... It does. Okay, that's good. Then I need to... And this is just a very rough sort of a timeline of the Old Testament, New Testament. And so in the middle there, we've just got, you know, the timeline. There's 1 AD, when obviously the time of Christ. Obviously we're up here at the moment, just after the year 2000 in comparison. And there's about 4,000 years before the time of Jesus. And obviously the main thing we're looking at is this gap here between the Old and the New Testament. And so on the top line there, we have got a bit of an idea of when some of the books of the Old Testament were written. Now, obviously, Genesis starts from the beginning, starts from the beginning of creation, and Genesis covers just over 2,000 years of history. So perhaps a bit of a question for the young ones. Who wrote Genesis? Moses, excellent. Well done. Now, the next question is, when was Moses alive?
4,000 BC.
Oh, well, that's creation. Adam and Eve were around then. No, what was one of the main events happening at the time of Moses?
Egypt,
excellent. Children of Israel exiting Egypt, the Exodus. So the Exodus is just here, right? So that's when Moses lived, which means at that time, that's when Moses wrote Genesis, Exodus, the other books, so Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers, right? The Pentateuch. So around that time. So if we go on a little bit, just to we'll come back to that slide in a second. So just to give a bit of an idea of the Old Testament. It was written, so all the books of the Old Testament were written between around 1440 BC through to 430 BC. So it took about 1,000 years for all of the books of the Old Testament to be written. But the history of the Old Testament covers just under 4,000 years. So from creation, 4,000 BC, through to 430 BC. The New Testament, on the other hand, and that's why you might want to have a look at the one that you've got there as we look at these. The New Testament, it was written, the books of the New Testament were written generally between 50 AD and 95 AD, over a period of, 45 years. The history of the New Testament covers about 90 to 100 years. So from 1 AD, from the birth of Christ, through to the time of John the Baptist writing the book of Revelation. Now, we're really just talking about sort of historical books there. Now, there's obviously prophetical books that talk about other things in the future as well, but we're just focused on the historical side of things there at the moment. Just coming back to this slide. Graham mentioned last book of the Old Testament. Graham, what was that?
Malachi,
excellent. Now, was Malachi the last book written? Anybody have a bit of a guess?
No,
it wasn't. Excellent. Anybody know what the last book of the Old Testament was that was written? Sam, do you know?
Nehemiah.
Yeah, it's probably Ezra and Nehemiah, those two books. Right? So it's fair to say that the books of the Old Testament are not in chronological order. Which means they don't immediately follow each other. The first few, obviously the first five books do. Once we start getting into the Kings, 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings, they do. They're reasonably chronologically aligned. 1st and 2nd Chronicles overlap with 1st and 2nd Samuel, 1st and 2nd Kings. Right? So there's sort of some overlap there. And then some of the other later books sort of cover off different bits of history as well. Now, the key thing about Ezra and Nehemiah being the last ones that were probably written there, and we've got them just up on the chart here on the line there, just in comparison, down on the bottom here, we do have some of the prophetical books and when they were written. Many of those were written during this time that the Jews were in exile in Babylon. So they've been taken captive and taken to Babylon. And that's what Ezra and Nehemiah tell us about, this time period when the Jews are in Babylon and they finally get the decree to come back to Israel to rebuild the temple and the walls of the city and that sort of thing. A couple of other things just to note. Between Genesis and Exodus, there is a little bit of a gap there as well of about 400 years when the children of Israel were in Egypt, as your boys correctly pointed out. So during that time when they were in Egypt, there's about 400 years that we don't have much detail about either, at the end of Genesis and once they then start to, once Moses comes on the scene and then they exit Egypt to return back to Israel. Okay, so let's look at this exile to Babylon. So hang on, perhaps if we just go back to this chart here. So yeah, we're talking about just at this end period, sort of around 500 or so BC, 500-600 BC, when the Jews are taken captive to Babylon. So we'll just go through this. We've got a little bit of detail here. So 605 BC, Nebuchadnezzar becomes king of Babylon. Daniel and the others are obviously taken to Babylon during that time. 597 BC, Nebuchadnezzar invades Jerusalem and Jehoiachin is taken to Babylon. 587 BC, Babylon attacks Judah and Jerusalem again. And Zedekiah and there's many other people are taken captive to Babylon as well. And then around 542 BC is when the Medo-Persian Empire comes. So, you know, we took the reading from Daniel chapter 2 about the image, the head of gold and chest of silver and the arms and that sort of thing. And we know that represents the four major empires at the time. And I have put them on this chart here as well that you can have a look at. So you get a bit of an idea of where those four major kingdoms occurred. And they overlap this period that we're looking at between the Testaments. So 538 BC, Cyrus, the king of Persia, he ends the exile and allows some of the Jews to return back to Israel and to Jerusalem to start to rebuild the city and the temple. And at that time, 538, Zerubbabel leads the return to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple. 458 BC, Ezra returns from Babylon as well, and then 445 BC, Nehemiah returns from Babylon. And that's where we get those time periods of Ezra and Nehemiah as well. So we are actually looking at a period in here of around 430 years. And it covers this period of the end of the Medo-Persian Empire, the time of the Greek Empire, and then the Romans as well. So the Romans come in just before the time of Christ. And so that's the next slide that we've got here. So the Babylonian Empire, 609 to 542 BC. The Medo-Persians, 542 to 334. So now I said we're looking at about 430 years, which means this gap between the Testaments starts at around 430 BC, which is obviously roughly in the middle of the Medo-Persian Empire. The whole of the Greek Empire is during that period, and then, as I say, the Roman Empire comes in around 67 BC, and it goes on till about 500 AD. You obviously see on the chart there, I've put the Roman Empire as being something that sort of fades out to grey because, as we know, the Roman Empire merged into the Holy Roman Empire, and we still have remnants of that with us today in the Roman Catholic Church that is still around in our society. So it's sort of the main parts of the Roman Empire faded out, but moved on. Okay. So in regards to the Jews returning from exile in Babylon, it's fair to say that the Persian rulers from Cyrus onwards were actually somewhat sympathetic towards the Jewish people, and they were quite happy for the Jews to return back to Israel. Cyrus issues a decree allowing the Jewish people to return to Jerusalem, and Darius, who follows Cyrus, permits the temple to be rebuilt. Later on, King Artaxerxes gives Ezra permission to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls of the city as well. So the Persian rulers were quite amiable to allowing the Jewish people to go back. Now, one thing I do want to sort of highlight here is at the end of the Old Testament, because the Israelite or the Jews have been taken captive to Babylon, there's been many invaders into Israel and into Jerusalem, and basically the city is trashed. And if we make a sort of a bit of a comparison between what Jerusalem and Israel was like at the end of the Old Testament to what it was like at the time of Jesus. At the end of the Old Testament, as I say, the place is trashed. The priesthood is in disarray. There's no regular temple services. We've got a group of pioneers trying to return from Babylon and trying to rebuild the city from scratch, and trying to re-establish the temple worship services. So it's basically a bunch of, you know, a group of pioneers almost, you know, trying to restart the city. In comparison to the time of Jesus, Jerusalem at that time is actually quite a cosmopolitan city. When Jesus appears in the New Testament, Jerusalem is a city that has lots of wealthy people, lots of people starting up businesses, anybody who you know, wants to make a living for themselves will be in Jerusalem trying to establish their business. It's well populated, and as I say, there's lots of wealthy people. There's great religious services in Jerusalem at the time of Jesus. Not always the right sort of religious services, but there's plenty of religious services going on. So it's all happening in Jerusalem at that time. And in contrast, you know, 430 years before that, the place was just ruined. Now, when the Jewish people return, they don't have, as I say, they don't have much, if any, trouble with the Persian rulers at the time. Jerusalem was able to be rebuilt and steadily repopulated. They gained momentum in building the population and particularly the temple worship. But unfortunately, it didn't last for long. Maybe about 100 years at best they spent rebuilding things. And then at the end of the Persian Empire, along comes the Greek Empire. And of course, what happens? The Greeks come and invade again. Now, if you've got your Bibles open, just turn with me to Daniel chapter 8. So we're going to have a look at Daniel chapter 8, and I'll read verses 20 to 22. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia, and the rough goat is the king of Grecia, and the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now, that being broken, whereas four stood up, for it four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in its own power. All right, so there's just a few verses there that tell us about, and obviously it's the interpretation of the prophecy of the ram and the goat, which is this transition between the Persian Empire and the Greek Empire. And it talks about when the Greek Empire starts, and that there is this great horn, or this great leader of the Greek Empire. And now, I don't know, do you boys know who was the first great Greek leader?
Alexander the Great.
Well, okay, Philip of Macedon, maybe. But Alexander the Great, of course. Right? Now, that's who this verse is talking about. This horn there is Alexander the Great. And history tells us, yes, it was Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great is followed by his four generals. And that's what the next verse talks about, that there's four kingdoms that come up after it. So Daniel is actually quite accurate here. Now, there's another chapter in Daniel that gives us even more detail about this time period. So turn with me to Daniel chapter 11. Now, of course, I don't plan to go through all of the details of Daniel chapter 11. There's an awful lot of information here, and it is very detailed. And It's interesting that it is so detailed that a lot of historians actually do not believe Daniel wrote the book of Daniel while he was in Babylon. It's so detailed when you break this down. Many historians actually say that Daniel wrote it anything from 150 to 200 BC. But, of course, Daniel actually wasn't alive then anyway. We all know Daniel is a prophetical writer, but it's interesting, yes, the actual detail that we see here is quite amazing, and because of that, yeah, many historians don't believe that it was prophetical. We'll start off with by looking at verses 2 to 4. So we'll just read those in Daniel chapter 11, starting at verse 2. "And now I will show thee the truth. Behold, there shall stand up yet three kings in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than they all. And by his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Grecia. And a mighty king shall stand up that shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he shall stand up, his kingdom shall be broken and shall be divided towards the four winds of heaven, and not to his posterity, nor according to his dominion, which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be plucked up, even for others besides those." Right. So, if we have a look at what we've got on the slide here. Now, what we've got on the next couple of slides, this came out of the study notes on Daniel, which does give a good explanation of it. Obviously, we don't have time to sort of go off and explore all of the history of this, but this is a fairly good summary here. So if we have a look at these verses, just comparing to what we've just read from the scriptures there, verse 2 mentions about three Persian emperors, and they were Cambyses, Smerdis, and Darius. And the fourth, who was much richer, was the Emperor Xerxes. Then in verse 3, it talks about the Grecians. Alexander the Great comes along, and he rules from 336 BC to 323 BC. And then after that, in verse 4, it talks about his four generals: Ptolemy Sota, Seleucus, Lysimachus, I think it is, and Cassander. And they all come into the picture around 320 BC. Now, none of these were his family relations, as it says there in the scriptures. You know, his kingdom is ruled over by people who are not his descendants. Ptolemy Sota becomes the king of Egypt, Allah the king of the south, and Seleucus becomes the king of Syria, or the king of the north. And that's what occurs during that time. Now, it's interesting, Alexander the Great, he only rules for about 13 years. So when you think what he achieved in those 13 years is quite amazing. Unfortunately, he liked celebrating quite a bit. And during a great celebration in Babylon, he drinks himself silly and gets so drunk that he dies. There's some debate as to whether he may have been poisoned, but most people agree that he probably just died of sheer drunkenness. And the Greek Empire, then from Alexander the Great, is referred to as the Hellenistic period, and the empire is split up between his four generals. And then they slowly transition to the King of the South and the King of the North, and the sort of the four generals end up sort of, you know, having a few wars between each other, and then they merge into these kings. Unfortunately, these wars go on for another 160 years between these generals, the kings of the north and kings of the south. And of course, so who's stuck in the middle? But of course, Israel and Jerusalem. And so the king of the north comes down, they have a war, fight over a few things, king of the south comes up, there's more battles and so forth. And once again, Israel, Jerusalem gets trashed again because of all of the wars. It becomes quite a mess, and there is a reference to quite a bit of detail that what goes on between the king of the north and the king of the south. If we have a look at verse 6 from chapter 11, I'll just read that, verse 6. "And in the end of the years they shall join themselves together, for the king's daughter of the south shall come to the king of the north to make an agreement, but she shall not retain the power of the arm, neither shall he stand nor his arm, but she shall be given up, and they that brought her, and he that begat her, and he that strengtheneth her in these times. Now, reads a little bit cryptic there, but we've got the interpretation there on the screen. Verse 6 tells us about Ptolemy Sota. He has a son, Ptolemy Philadelphus, around 285 BC to 247 BC, and they had a daughter, Berenice. Berenice marries Antiochus Theos, who is the king of the north. So in actual fact, she becomes a traitor because she's from the king of the south and she goes and marries the king of the north. Right? Now, the complete opposite happens a little bit later on in verse 17, where Antiochus had a daughter, Cleopatra, who marries Ptolemy, Epiphanes, the king of the south. So a daughter of the king of the north comes down and marries the king of the south during this time. So this constant sort of bickering between the king of the north and the king of the south goes on for 160 years. And Daniel chapter 11 details all of this conflict that's occurring during that time, during the Greek Empire. Okay, so before we sort of get too carried away with the details of this, I just want to come back here to the beginning and just a quick reference back to verses 3 and verse 6. So verse 3 tells us about Alexander the Great, and verse 6 particularly tells us about this Ptolemy Philadelphus during this time. Now, when Alexander the Great, during his rule, who goes and invades Egypt, he establishes a city down there, Alexandria. Now, Alexander the Great had a great habit of, everywhere he went, creating a city, call it Alexandria. But he creates one down in Egypt. And while he's there, he sets it up as a centre of Greek culture. And have a look further on. As I say, we won't sort of go into all of the detail there, but a few things just to note. Verses 21 to 31 tell us about the reign of Antiochus Epiphanes, and it's minutely detailed in the scriptures there. He conducts a war with Egypt from 171 to 168 BC, going for 3 years, in which he was actually successful as well. Now, what happens during this time is that he sends... this Antiochus Epiphanes sends this Apollonius, one of his generals, as we've got there in verse 30. Antiochus Epiphanes sends Apollonius with about 20,000 men to go and destroy Jerusalem. Yet again, the place gets broken up. The walls of the city are broken down, houses set on fire, and they actually defile the temple. So the Greeks go and invade, they defile the temple by sacrificing a pig on the altar in the temple in Jerusalem. So the Jews are obviously, you know, horrified at this. Some say that that this was Jupiter, that this profanity was done. So we've got there in verse 31, the temple in Jerusalem is profaned with the Greek idol image of Zeus or Olympus. Some records recall that as being Jupiter, which is actually the Roman god of gods, so the main god. So Greek and Roman influence had started to really push its way into the Jewish nation at the time. So much so that there is a decree made by the Greeks that Jews are no longer able to worship, that they have to worship Greek gods, and they try to put an end to all Jewish teaching altogether. Jewish sacrifices are forbidden at the time, and Jews are not even allowed to keep the Holy Sabbath day. The books of the law, it's recorded, the Jewish scriptures were publicly burned as well. And Greek temples are set up everywhere around the place. It's a pretty horrific time when the Greeks come in and invade. And just sort of put that into context, I mean, if you just think about the fact that if somebody came in here and forcibly removed all of our Bibles from us, burnt them all for us, and basically threatened us to, you know, to worship some other false gods and idols at the risk of basically killing us. That's the sort of situation they're in. So it's not a nice time at all. And essentially by this time, many of the Jews have had enough. The Greek influence is just too much. They've just had enough. All of this fighting that keeps going on in their land. The temple's been trashed again. They've been forced to worship Greek idols. And then verses 30 and 34 is where we start to see the beginning of this uprising of the Maccabeans. Okay, so let's have a look at, we'll read a few verses out of, again, out of Daniel 11. Verses 32 to 34. And such as do wickedly against the covenant shall be corrupt by flatteries, but the people that do know their God shall be strong and do exploits, and they that understand among the people shall instruct many, yet they shall fall by the sword and by flame, by captivity and by spoil many days. Now when they shall fall, they shall be holpen or helped with a little help, but many shall cleave to them with flatteries. Now, what's this talking about? Well, have a look at the slide here, verses 32 to 34. Verse 32, where it mentions people that do know their God, the true God. And this is the Maccabeans and various others as well at the time that know their God. Verse 33, the Maccabeans continue to preach the word of God during this time, but they were persecuted while doing it. Verse 34, Judas Maccabeus rises up an army against Antiochus Epiphanes and defeats him in 164 BC. So who are the Maccabeans? Let's have a look at that and get a bit of an idea of who they are. Starts off with Mattathias, who is a Jewish priest from the village of Modin. 167 BC, they start a revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes. Mattathias Maccabeus has five sons: Judas, Eleazar, Simon, John, and Jonathan. And just a year later, Mattathias dies. Judas assumes the leadership of the revolt, and all the details of this are actually recorded in Josephus, the Jewish historian, and also the first and second of Maccabees from the Apocrypha. Just to give you a little bit of background here, the story of Mattathias goes, and I'll read this, that one day a Syrian official comes to the town of Modin and tries to get Mattathias to influence the locals to commence Greek idol worship. Verse 32 that we read there in Daniel 11 mentions that they come with flatteries. And so it's recorded that this Syrian official comes offering Mattathias and his sons a great amount of wealth and reward for their assistance to introduce Greek idol worship into their area. Now, of course, Mattathias fiercely rejects this offer. But unfortunately, not all of the Jews are so faithful or resilient against the persistent offers from the Syrians. And with the persistent offers, there is a Jewish local who steps forward to place a sacrifice on the altar to one of the Greek gods. Mattathias, his anger takes control. He steps forward and grabs a sword and kills his fellow Jew who is about to sacrifice to the Greek god. He then kills the Syrian officer and he breaks down the altar to the Greek god. Now, keep in mind that at this time, the Greek rulers have forced everybody to worship Greek idols. So the Greek worship is very much entrenched in society. But Mattathias and many others are trying to resist it the whole time. And of course, when this local Jew goes to place the sacrifice on the altar to one of the Greek gods, Mattathias goes and kills him, and he kills the Syrian. Right? So essentially, they become rebels at the time. Mattathias and his sons, they go off and hide for a short time. But basically, it's on. The rebellion started now. And the rebellion essentially steps up a gear from this time onwards, from 167 BC. more and more it gains momentum. There's more support from more Jews around the place who start to join this rebellion. Now, the Bible doesn't actually tell us much about this at all. And so obviously we ask the question, well, what is this book of the Maccabees and how come it's not in the Bible? Although for some people it might be, if you've got the right sort of Bible. So some Bibles do contain it. So we're going to spend a little bit of time just to talk about the Apocrypha. The Apocrypha, sometimes referred to as the deuterocanonical books by Catholics. The Apocrypha is often referred to as being a set of books that appear between the Old Testament and the New Testament. But in actual fact, that's not strictly correct, because not all of these books appear during that time. It includes about 15 books. The majority of them are written in Hebrew, and they're written between about 300 BC and about 100 AD after Christ. They are contained in some of the oldest Christian manuscripts that they look at. They can find them. Luther's Bible of 1534 had this intertestamental section that contained the books. The Geneva Bible in 1560 had the same. 1647, the Westminster Confession actually excluded the Apocrypha. And then later it's considered Catholic by some British Protestants, so of course they won't consider the Apocrypha books at all. And then by the time we get to the early 19th century, British and Foreign Bible Society actually refused to print any of the Apocrypha books as well. And so that sort of explains why we don't have it in our scriptures. These are some of the Apocrypha books. There is Tobit or Tobias, Judith, the Book of Wisdom. Just given the time, we won't be able to go through all of these in much detail. Ecclesiasticus, 1st and 2nd of Maccabees, which is a historical book and does give us some of the history that we're interested in. There is the Book of Barak, 1st and 2nd of Esdras. And interesting enough, 1st and 2nd of Esdras is almost word for word the same as Ezra, but it just starts at a slightly different time period. So there's a little bit more detail included in Esdras. There are updates to the Book of Esther and also to the Book of Daniel and likewise the Book of Psalms. There are five more Psalms that are included in the Apocrypha. In the books of Esther and Daniel, there are additional verses included in them. I can sort of speak more about the ones in the books of Daniel, particularly looking at Daniel chapter 13 and 14. They're written in quite a different style from the rest of the book of Daniel. They're more written as a bit of a folklore type style, because Daniel was well known later on in history and people had stories about him. And chapters 13 and 14 were written obviously sometime later, so they're not really a part of the main book of Daniel that we've got. Now, we're going to have a bit of a reading from the first of Maccabees chapter 3, so I'm going to get Graham back up here to read it. Now, if you haven't got it, that's okay, because we've got it on the screen. No, just down to verse 26, I think.
26, okay, so from the start, 26. Yeah.
Okay, for the first time in probably several years, we have 1 Maccabees chapter 3. His son Judas, known as Maccabeus, then took his place. All his brothers and all who had attached themselves to his father supported him, and they fought for Israel with a will. He extended the fame of his people. Like a giant, he put on the breastplate and buckled on his war harness. He engaged in battle after battle, protecting the ranks with his sword. He was like a lion in his exploits, like a young lion roaring over its prey. He pursued and tracked down the renegades. He consigned those who troubled his people to the flames. The renegades quailed with the terror he inspired. All evildoers were utterly confounded, and deliverance went forward under his leadership. He brought bitterness to many a king and rejoicing to Jacob by his deeds. His memory is blessed for ever and ever. He went through the towns of Judah, eliminating the irreligious from them and diverted the retribution from Israel. His name resounded to the ends of the earth. He rallied those who were on the point of perishing. Next, Apollonius mustered the Gentiles and a large force from Samaria to make war on Israel. When Judas learned of it, he went out to meet him and routed and killed him. Many fell wounded, and the survivors took flight. Their spoils were seized, and the sword of Apollonius was taken by Judas, who used it to fight with throughout his life. On hearing that Judas had raised a mixed force of believers and seasoned fighters, Siron, commander of the Syrian troops, said, "I shall make a name for myself and gain honour in the kingdom if I fight Judas and those supporters of his who are so contemptuous of the king's orders." He therefore launched another expedition with a strong army of unbelievers to support him in taking revenge on the Israelites. He had nearly reached the descent of Beth-horon when Judas went out to confront him with a handful of men. But as soon as these saw the force advancing to meet them, they said to Judas, "How can we, few as we are, engage such overwhelming numbers? We are exhausted as it is, not having had anything to eat today." "It is easy," Judas answered, "for a great number to be defeated by a few. Indeed, in the sight of heaven, deliverance, whether by many or few, is all one. For victory in war does not depend on the size of the fighting force. Heaven accords the strength. They are coming against us in full-blown insolence and lawlessness to destroy us, our wives and our children, and to plunder us. But we are fighting for our lives and our laws, and he will crush them before our eyes. Do not be afraid of them." When he had finished speaking, he made a sudden sally against Seron and his force and overwhelmed them. Judas pursued them down from Beth-horon as far as the plain. About 800 of their men fell, and the rest took refuge in the country of the Philistines. Judas and his brothers began to be feared, and alarm seized the surrounding peoples. His name even reached the king's ears, and among the nations there was talk of Judas and his battles. A few modern parallels there, maybe.
Thanks, Graham. Now, the books of the Maccabees repeatedly stress that the Jews fought, above all, to defend their holy place. The temple was the symbol of the whole law to them. It was their whole religion. And as verse 2 mentions there, they fought for Israel with a will, with a passion. That was their life. These were certainly violent times, and a lot of the Maccabees tells us about these wars and this constant fighting. One of the key things I do want to point out in this is in verses 18 and 19 here that we've got on the screen, where Judas says to his men who are sort of afraid, he says, "This is easy. You know, a great number can be defeated by a few indeed. In the sight of heaven, deliverance, whether by many or by few, it is one." And he's referring to God. Judas Maccabeus was actually a very faithful servant of God. He trusted in God, as it says there, you know, heaven accords the strength, and trusted in God for his victories. So, yes, the rest of the book of the Maccabees, you know, covers more history there. So we'll just have a look at a little bit more about Judas Maccabeus. At this time, you know, Antiochus Epiphanes, king of the north, comes down. He sends Lysias to quell the Jewish uprising, but fails. Judas retakes Jerusalem in 164 BC. The temple is purified and the daily sacrifice is restored. Victory is celebration of the feast of dedication, Hanukkah. Now, for any book, oh, I suppose you boys go to Hebron, don't you? Heritage, sorry, don't you? Yes. You would have learnt about Hanukkah, have you? Come across Hanukkah yet?
Yeah.
A little bit, okay. No worries. This victory of Judas Maccabeus, is sort of such a famous victory that it, it, it's remembered throughout history. They retake the temple, they purify it, they clean it, they destroy the Greek idols, they reinstate the daily sacrifice, and it becomes an occasion for such joyous celebration. It becomes an annual celebration, as we said, as the Feast of Dedication. And so much so that Judas Maccabeus is actually considered as a hero by the Jews nowadays. You know, they see him as quite a famous hero throughout their history. Also, the famous composer, George Frederick Handel, composes his oratorio around Judas Maccabeus, putting this story of this victory of Judas Maccabeus to music. And much later on, the oratorio is converted into an Easter hymn, which is the hymn that we sung to begin with. So hymn 257, and if you have your hymn books there, at the beginning of the hymn, or just at the title there, it actually has written Maccabeus there, because it was written by Handel originally for about this victory of Judas Maccabeus. Now, it was at the time, it was referred to as "See the Conquering Hero Comes." That was the original title, or "Hail the Conquering Hero." That was how it was written to begin with. Later on, this tune is reused and the words are changed to refer to Christ. "Thine be the glory, risen conquering Son." So that's where that hymn comes from. This is what the celebration of Hanukkah is about, to remember this great victory that Judas Maccabeus had. This is the family tree of the Maccabeans. So we'll just quickly run through this. So there's Mattathias at the top there, his five sons, Judas Maccabeus here. The whole of this sort of family tree is actually recorded in the first and second of the books of Maccabees. It comes down through this line of Simon Maccabeus, and he has sons, John Hyrcanus the first, another Mattathias there in Judah, and then through John Hyrcanus the first, he ends up with more sons, Aristobulus the first, Alexander, Antigonus, Alexandra Salome there as well, and we have Hyrcanus the second and Aristobulus the second. Now, the interesting thing to note here is that the names of these descendants, as you can sort of hear in their names, are becoming very Greek. They're very Hellenistic names. So although they start out Mattathias and Judas Maccabeus, you know, and the five sons start out as this rebellious group, very much against the Greeks and the Greek rulership and Greek worship. Over a couple of generations, their descendants start to get influenced by the Greek culture and so forth. They start to take on Greek names as well. Now, just given the time, I'll have to skip a couple of things here. But what I do want to point out here is that once it gets to Hyrcanus the second and Aristobulus the second, the family divides quite a bit. And these brothers are actually at each other quite a lot, because Hyrcanus the second becomes the high priest, and Aristobulus the second kind of wants to get a bit of the rulership as well. He wants to be in a position of power too. For a brief time, there is a civil war in Jerusalem again, and mainly because of the fact that there's been this split in the family between these two. By the time we get down through this, unfortunately, we're not going to have time to sort of run through this whole sort of Hasmonean dynasty here. What does happen, and the main thing that I want to call out, is that this divide in the family is where we get the Pharisees and the Sadducees from. Because these two parts of the family wanted to sort of have rule in Israel and Jerusalem, And they essentially run as sort of political leaders for a bit, but they try to run the religious side of things as well. But they're constantly bickering at each other. And so for about 160 years, various descendants of these are just having a go at each other the whole time. And there's lots of bribery, fairly typical of most political situations, really, when you think about it. Everybody's trying to bribe each other, stab in the back, both figuratively and literally in many cases. But eventually what forms out of this is the Pharisees and the Sadducees that are around at the time of Christ. And that's probably the main thing that I really want people to take away from this. So as I say, there's this infighting within the Maccabean family, the civil war that I mentioned earlier. They're fighting over the kingship and the priestly role, and eventually we get to see the Pharisees and the Sadducees form. Now, unfortunately, I've had to sort of jump a fair bit of that just due to the course of time. So that's probably where I'll leave it at the moment, because at this time, once the Pharisees and the Sadducees start to come in on the scene, we also start to see the Roman rulerships come in as well, and the Roman Empire starts to come in. So just as a quick sort of preview, what we've looked at is the timelines of the Old Testament and the New Testament. A bit of historical context there of when the books were written and what parts of history they covered. Looked at a few key things there, particularly around this time period, from the details that we get from Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7 about the Babylonian, Greek, Roman empires. Daniel 11 gives us lots of detail about it. We've had a bit of a look at the Maccabees and the Apocrypha. A quick skim through the Hasmonean dynasty and an introduction to the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So next time we will talk a little bit more about the Pharisees and the Sadducees, what they're doing, how they're running things, what their influence is. We'll have a look at the Roman Empire and there's some details there, the family of Herod as well. And one thing I will point out, just while we've got the moment, we'll come back here. You can see down the bottom of this slide, we do have Herod listed there. An interesting fact is that Herod is actually a descendant of the Maccabean family as well. It sort of branches out off the side a little bit further out sort of off from Matthias here, but there's another line of descendants that come down, and that's where Herod comes from. So really quite strange when we read about the activities of Herod in the New Testament and how much of a sort of a cruel person he was. Next time we'll have a look at how much of a mess their family was, and get a bit of an idea of that. And then we'll look at the time of Christ and who's ruling at that, and look at some verses in the New Testament where some of these rulers are mentioned. Okay, I might just leave it there. Thanks, Graham.